The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Tired planet of ours, a lot of trouble everywhere. Glad to have you on board tonight. We're going to look at some material this evening that has never been seen by the general public. Only a very few people, literally a handful of people in some cases, have been able to read this material over the years. It comes from the past, usually the best place to learn about the present and the future. Tonight, another conversation with William Mills Tompkins. Bill has been with us many times and is developing what is obviously an extraordinarily important development in disclosure about advanced propulsion technology. ET, UFO, ours, theirs, reptilians, Nordics. The whole idea is being able to move from point A to point B, whether it's in our solar system, whether it's intergalactic, whether it's a universe of travel. You've got to be able to get from A to B. Maybe you want to stop along the way and have some coffee, that's fine too. But the point is propulsion. That's the key. And what we're going to do tonight is talk to Bill Tompkins about things he knows, things he's experienced in his extraordinary lifetime, all about secret, advanced propulsion systems. And if you have looked at the homepage down in the top area near the bottom of the political arts section, you'll find there is a picture of deep space and some text. And the text, very important. It says, as I've been intimating, a world first, the above secret disclosure of advanced deep space propulsion systems. Remember what I said, it's all about propulsion. You've got to have a means of moving a spaceship, a spacecraft, from one point to another. The material is now posted. I have just posted it. Released for the first time ever, dozens of pages of documents never seen before pertaining to the most advanced U.S. space physics technology of their day and of our day. These documents go back to the oldest one I've seen is relating to a book published by Dr. Oberth from 1929. The general time frame of these documents is 1950, 51 to 55. They come from Douglas Aircraft Corporation, which came to be known as McDonnell Douglas Missiles in Space. And what we're going to try to allow all of you to experience by putting these documents up, thanks to Bill Tompkins. I don't know where he got them, how he got them, that's his business, but they are essentially above top secret. No one was allowed to see these. These documents emanated from the ultra-secret black ops programs at Douglas Aircraft, where Bill Tompkins worked. These were compartmentalized, they were ultra-secret, and they dealt with, essentially, an awful lot of German scientific physics genius. That's where much of it came from. You'll see as you go through these documents. Look on that third piece of art at the top of the page where it says click here, and you can go to it right now if you'd like. There's plenty to read, and there will be more coming. But this is a story, again, about physics and about technology. And when you see where we were in, say, 1951, 52, and where others had been before that, you are going to be stunned. It is truly amazing. Ionic propulsion engines in 1950, and what Dr. Oberth was writing about in 1929, it's really amazing. Bill Tompkins, hello and welcome back.
Hey, I'm right here. Sounds good, Jeff. I think it's going to be an interesting evening for everybody.
I'm sure it will be, and I want to thank you very much for making this material available. It has never been seen before. It was the most secret of documentation, certainly in the early 1950s, in many respects, I think, of all. Fair statement?
Absolutely.
Now, you were there. You were there when all this happened, and if you've listened to the conversations between Bill and myself before, you'll understand about the Nordics and how they were clearly involved with Douglas Aircraft and these think tank black ops centers that were visited and worked in by Bill Tompkins. There are, again, so many things involved here. We won't get through all of it tonight, but it's up there now for you to take a look at and to just be fascinated by. Here's one little quick tidbit for you. This is from one of the pages, and it says, it's giving credit here, reproduced by J.W. Edwards, Edwards Brothers, Ann Arbor, Michigan, 1945, under license of Alien Property Custodian. What
oh
is that?
Goodness.
What does that mean? Who was the alien property custodian, and what was the function of that individual or that group? And what other materials did they have under their authority? That's just one little tiny three-sentence, three-line tidbit from this documentation, and it just goes and goes and goes. I think the main thing that we have to keep in mind always when we talk to Bill is this really originates in the 1920s and 30s for the most part, and comes from Germany. This is German scientific genius, aided and abetted, if not ignited in some ways, by reptilian alien visitors who took a liking, for whatever reason, to Germans and Germany and were working with them, giving them knowledge, giving them data, and actually giving them hardware, disks to use, to fly, and to copy. That's how the Germans got their disk program. And I think you've seen, hopefully many of you, if you haven't, go look on the right-hand side of the homepage down and find Bill Tompkins' featured story, and you'll see pictures, photos, dozens of them, of their old black and white pictures of German flying saucers from the 1930s and 40s. They're there. So where would you like to start, Bill?
Well, actually, I guess we should sort of say what the document's title actually is, because I think the title of this document is extremely interesting. It's called MTM-622. And then it says, unconventional propulsion schemes. What in the world would that be?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh. Part two, 3155, Santa Monica Division, Douglas Aircraft Company, Incorporated. Wow. Okay. So what this is, it's like you've said, we're talking the 1950s, 51, 2, 3, and 4 time period. But much of the data that's in here actually occurred way before that.
Yeah.
And I think that what's most interesting about this document is that we had the vice president of engineering in Douglas who headed up a secret think tank inside of Douglas that all of the classified engineers didn't even know existed in Douglas. And at one time, there was roughly 200 of these people, which were studying, oh my gosh, a propulsion, space propulsion.
Uh-huh.
Now, as you go through this document, you're going to see that actually Elmer Wheaton, the vice president, and then his assistant, who was actually ahead of this program, were constantly talking to other people, primarily in Southern California, that were involved with, unconventional propulsion schemes. Now, nobody said anything about these being extraterrestrial, okay? And it's interesting that all of these different physicists, PhDs of the top level in Caltech, in UCLA, in the top technical organizations back east, were contacted by Elmer Wheaton, and they were interviewed to what their program actually was and looking at propulsion of space vehicles. Everybody knew that what we were doing was based on extraterrestrial information that the Germans had acquired and actually before World War II and were implementing production contracts to build a number of different types of extraterrestrial military vehicles. Wow. So when you look at this information, you're seeing that many organizations throughout the country are working on this. Different laboratories are working on it.
Mm-hmm.
And now remember that all of these same people, I would say 80% of the people that are listening in here that are not actually employed by Douglas, but were advisors to the secret think tank, had already gotten a package about extraterrestrial systems from Admiral Riccobana's information of his operatives that had brought back the information from Germany.
Which you attended the debriefing of, and you came to be the man who flew these packets of ultra-secret information to various think tanks and universities and others who were involved with the project. You were the man who spread the material around.
Yes, I was the disseminator of this data. And so here we are now, years later, because that was back in 52 and or 42 and 43. Now we're 52 and 53, and we're in Douglas. And here we have all of these top-level specialists, the top technical people in your country working inside of a secret think tank.
Right.
And these people have all been previously given packages from Admiral Riccobata during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still struggling with definitions for how to design and build different propulsion systems for different space missions. And I think it's extremely interesting, the year that we got 10 years later or whatever, and we're still struggling. So what you're going to read from the papers that are available is their information and their approach, which is surprisingly different. Like you would think everybody would go with one particular approach.
Right, sure,
and
understand.
These fellows went with dozens and dozens of different ways to try to come up with a propulsion system that would carry personnel, military personnel, out into the galaxy to other stars, planets. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So what we really have then is detailed information, and surprisingly enough, not to be differing, being different with you, Jeff, yes, this information was the highest classification in the country. But when we delivered, when I delivered packages to the different universities mm-hmm. and the naval research centers, not one piece of paper was actually stamped even confidential, let alone secret. Everybody knew it. Everybody knew what they were playing with.
Right.
Everybody understood what they were dealing with. And they operated as if the information was at the highest classification known in the country, even though some of the documents were not even classified
right.
confidential.
Well, that's a very interesting way to keep something out of the crosshairs of general intelligence, spies, and surveillance operations. It's not classified. Okay, so it tends to stay outside of the field of view. That was a very interesting way to classify something, not to classify it. But the general content of it, when anybody who got this read it, they knew instantly that this was hot stuff. You don't push it around. So yeah, they didn't
Absolutely.
Need to. It was so incredibly important, it didn't need to be stamped, because that would have targeted it for spies, I would think. Make it easy for them to take it in and... Go ahead.
You're correct. Yes, that was the reason.
Here, okay, let me read a little bit more just for our listeners to give them an idea here, and then don't lose your place. This is so fascinating, all of it. Now, this is... We're talking about something here that refers back to a book by Dr. Oberth from 1923 and 1926, and some of it goes back even further than that. You have to think of the time frame. This is a brief abstract and some comments. Most of the book by Oberth is devoted to liquid fuel rockets, fundamental principles, dynamics, control, and astronautic speculations. Only the last, the 22nd chapter, 15 pages, deals with what today would be called an unconventional method of propulsion. This, remember, is 1923, called ionic. He called it electric propulsion. This is way back in the silent film days, in the early days. Already on page 110, Oberth states categorically, and if you don't know who Oberth was, look him up, O-B-E-R-T-H, that contemporary science knows of three devices which would theoretically permit impelling a vehicle to escape velocity: the rocket, the electromagnetic gun, and the electric wind engine, electric propulsion. He admits on page 111 of his book that electric propulsion from takeoff would entail gigantic expenditures. However, as soon as a satellite station is established on a supra-atmospheric orbit, they're talking about satellites in 1920, he advocates electric propulsion as a means to produce 2 to 10 times greater exhaust velocities than by any chemical rocket. This man was a true visionary, a genius. This was all kept from the public. Nobody knew about any of this in 1920. And here it is being discussed and utilized in the early 1950s and recited chapter and verse in these abstracts and comments in the papers that are up there for you right now, thanks to Bill Tompkins. These have never been seen before, these papers. Keep that in mind. Okay, go ahead.
Well, it's just that the information that's in here, as you're saying, many of the people that were doing the studies, like in the 20s or even like in 1918,
the teens, yeah, right,
were addressing extraterrestrial propulsion. They were addressing extraterrestrial people, and that because there were so many people who had been contacted in Germany by different extraterrestrials, it was a common subject to discuss the propulsion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I'd like to say is that, and I'm going to get a little bit off base, let's look at this think tank inside of Douglas. Okay? In some of the earlier structures of investigations by the Navy primarily, a group was put together in Douglas by the president of Douglas Aircraft, Donald Douglas Sr. He and two Navy admirals and two Army Air Corps generals,
mm-hmm.
Pat Arnold being one of them, put together a program after they had seen the UFOs over Los Angeles in 1942.
February 1942, the so-called Battle of L.A.
Yeah, so those fellas all got together, and it was settled that instead of doing this in the Navy or the Army Air Corps, they were going to do it inside of Douglas Engineering. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
In a secret think tank that was never referred to as a think tank. That all came years later, but you just were exposed to the first aerospace think tank. Now, these fellows then worked for several years and were addressing virtually every possible subject that could come up. Later, like TRW did, only they went 10 times further. So these individuals, which are the people that are in this document, select for unconventional propulsion schemes. These people then worked together and as a group inside of engineering.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I worked for on and off for 12 and a half years. Now, the organization then had a problem with security. And so it was decided that this group of people would separate from Douglas and form their own research group over in a rented office complex in Santa Monica.
Mm-hmm.
And they called themselves the RAND Group. And when you read all the times, you're going to say, okay, it's R-A-N-D. Well, what's R-A-N-D? Quite frankly, it's very simple. Research and development.
Got it.
Maybe that's not the best way, but that's what it really is.
Sure.
And, of course, the thrust was extraterrestrial, not just propulsion. So now we have this RAND Group, which at the time I came in, they had just made the divorce. And I say divorce because it was a fantastically difficult for 200 of these people who have been working inside of Douglas to make the decision whether they wanted to go to a separate organization, where they wanted to stay in advanced design at Douglas, or did they want to just work back and forth between them. And so roughly of the 200, roughly 140 people went permanently into the new RAND facility. I say permanently because a third of them came back to Douglas after I got there. And I got there in 52.
Uh-huh.
And so what we have here then is the individual physicist, PhD's, trust, what direction he was going to personally develop. So obviously propulsion was the biggest problem. Communications and navigation and these, all the other areas were just put aside, and roughly 95% was all propulsion. What in the world can we propel these things by? What do we have to do?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's sort of the atmosphere that I went into, where we still had a substantial number of the PhDs working and not wanting to address the RAND group themselves, but were thrusting even more into the mission aspect, and then the requirements for different propulsion for long-range missions. It got very complicated. And my point is that these people were essentially the top people on your planet studying this, with the exception of the geniuses in Germany.
Uh-huh.
And that's a very real statement. And I think that we don't give Germany itself enough of the of the history that they've been involved in many different technical fields.
Well, they've been shorted by what we call history hugely ever since the war, for obvious reasons. The winners write the story. But this goes back, as you've said, to the 20s and the 30s. Werner Oberth was incredible, and he's not the only one. These people were in contact with off-planet intelligence, which was seriously engaged in helping us crawl up out of the mud and to take our place among the stars. And if you look at the click here in that third homepage art piece, you'll see it. Just go down below the two above it. Click here. That'll take you to the main index page, which is the repository of all the documentation that Bill is alluding to now. And you can read the introduction. Then you've got five links to click on below that, PDFs. There are about 80 pages already up there. And do read the quotations of Ben Rich, the former director of Lockheed Skunk Works, shortly before he passed. These are stunning statements. They're all true. They're all real. And once you can accept that as a stepping stone to jump into this incredible information treasure that we have up there now. Because remember, it's all about perspective. If you don't understand what happened in the past, you'll understand where we are now. And without that past, it all becomes fuzzy for a lot of people. So you started at Douglas in 1952. I think my father started in 56 or 57, something like that. He was there at the same time Bill was for years. And I used to hear some little snippets here and there about how unusual a place Douglas was to work. He knew. He went to all the launches at Cape Canaveral, later KSC, and then, of course, Vandenberg. And he knew von Braun and others. He wouldn't talk much about it, though. He was the director of public relations, and he had a good idea of what was going on. Not as much as Bill, by any means, but he knew. And I used to hear about it when I was a little kid. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, I think that's very interesting, too, because he actually, your dad, actually attended not just Blanche's, but he went down where they were doing the planning for missions, where they were doing program modifications. He got into the various laboratories down at the Cape. And, so he was involved in and exposed to White Sands Proving Ground, where all other testing was taking place on a massive program.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew what was going on, so his position was to make sure certain things didn't get out and other things that were needed did get out. And I think that's a very important position.
Yeah, you're so right, and you've summed it up perfectly. Yeah, it's like that's the actual tap. You turn it on, you turn it off. You drip here, you drip there. Very, very interesting. It must have been an incredible environment. The 1950s in this country, so much was going on that people just don't understand or appreciate at this point. That's another reason why these documents are so absolutely fascinating to look through. Go ahead, Mr. Tompkins. This is amazing.
Okay. Once again, when you talked about RAM, that is still the number one technical organization on the planet for the United States.
Mm-hmm.
They have facilities right here in San Diego. They've got facilities all over the planet on different programs. And the RAM Corporation is the number one technical organization involved in extraterrestrial. I think it's very interesting that came out of the secret think tank inside of Douglas.
Fascinating. Oh. And it what it means is research and development, R&D. That's funny. It's amazing.
Okay, when you start looking through the different pages, you're going to see many different people are interviewed. And when I say interviewed, this is my boss inside the secret think tank was Dr. Klemperer. He was a German. He was brilliant. But he had come to United States, like back in the 30s,
mm-hmm.
and ended up in engineering at Douglas. And then when the program got started on extraterrestrial, he was then assigned that position. He ran it. His boss then was the vice president of engineering.
Mm.
And like we said before, when manufacturing started to take over the company, which you shouldn't allow, they knew that there were things going on in engineering that are way over what we were supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so they started to investigate the think tank. And so programs were set up to where a big discussion took place. And finally, they took the reins away from Donald Douglas Sr., and took over the company. And so our vice president of engineering, the principal person in the secret think tank, quit Douglas and went over to Lockheed and became a principal individual running the Lockheed Skunk Works.
Uh-huh.
And I have to say it's interesting that when the situation got so bad that you couldn't talk anymore, and so the best thing to do is to quit and go someplace else.
Uh-huh.
That was a 180, which, of course, totally ruined Douglas. And later on, McDonnell bought Douglas,
mm-hmm.
and then even later, Boeing bought McDonnell Douglas.
Yeah.
This document, this gee whiz, this unconventional propulsion schemes, okay? I personally worked on probably 20, maybe 30 of these different programs when I was in the secret think tank. So this document is not mine. Jeff, you wanted to know how I got it. This is my working document
that
I happened to take home when I left the company. Actually, it's a different story, but I got fired for taking the information to NASA, Von Braun and Dr. Debus. And the company got a $79 million systems engineering contract,
uh-huh.
and I got to work on that for a couple of months, and then they fired me. And it was the manufacturing people who actually had me fired, believe it or not. But that's
as so many firings, that's crazy. That's nuts.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying, this document itself, I think is really important, because you can read through this, you can understand what these people were doing way back then, and you're talking about years ago, and yet most people, even in this program on extraterrestrial, the technical,
uh-huh.
Had no idea that this document existed, or that all of these people were technical consultants to the secret think tank.
Huh.
Even though you had, we had like 60 or 70 still after the separation that were inside the engineering department, which was a separate structure inside.
Uh-huh.
But it was a facility that was implementing every possible method of coming up, not with just one propulsion. You have to realize that you first have to define a mission. Is it a mission to the moon? Is it a mission to Mars?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a mission to, say, Alpha Centauri, our
mm-hmm.
closest star?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a mission to the 12th star of the nearest stars? There's different requirements for different ranges of continuous flight. And so you're reading different people's approach way back then that they were doing this.
Right.
And I think this is a staggering document to go through.
Oh, and it fills in an enormous gap in our knowledge timeline. People don't even understand that this was being discussed, talked about by Hermann Oberth, for example, in the 1920s, the teens, even before that. And I again repeat the book that we are citing in some of the documents that you provided, first published in Munich and Berlin in 1929, and then reproduced by J.W. Edwards of Edwards Brothers, Ann Arbor, in 1945, under the license, this is key, of Alien Property Custodian. So this publishing company got the rights to reproduce Oberth's book from 1929 in 1945 under government license of Alien Property Custodian. Okay? I hope that helps give you an idea of the ET component in this enormous effort that was going on. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, if you just read Westinghouse propulsion system was contacted, and they, of course, were working on other approaches themselves for propulsion, because that's their business.
Right, sure.
And Lockheed is into it, but they're primarily into it for the vehicle and then the propulsion to operate the vehicle. And Bell Telephone people are in it. And so you have the major corporations involved in a Douglas secret think tank program for different types of extraterrestrial type vehicles that will be able to operate out in the galaxy, not the solar system, but out in the galaxy. And so Westinghouse, being a major producer of engines, reciprocating type, and then later jet engines, they're obviously the people that are working on space propulsion. Then you have over at Pasadena, you have the Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
And these people are in this program. They're supporting the Douglas technical program to produce propulsion, even though that's their job.
Uh-huh.
They then were advisors to Elmer Wheaton and Dr. Klemperer. And so Klemperer himself went to these facilities. Once in a while, they would come to Douglas. But what I'm trying to say is you don't realize how many different propulsion systems were being addressed and the multiple number of companies or your organizations, universities,
mm-hmm.
which were working at a secret level on a system that nobody even knew where to start. And and many of them had packages 10 years earlier from the U.S. Navy, Naval Air Station San Diego, Admiral Rickabatta's information from his operatives out of Germany again. And I think that this sequence of events, this timeline that we're talking about here, is amazing at what was taking place so many years back and had been taking the top technical people in Germany and the top people later on in the United States. That's the number one mission of any other thing that was being studied.
Mm-hmm.
This is a tremendous little document.
Well, it's one of those compendiums of documents that you can open it up anywhere and start reading and find something just fascinating. There is more. Here, let's see. I don't know, what date is this? 1953. This is Professor Dr. E. Sanger, Paris, took a step into the distant future with his lecture on photon rockets. 1953. Theoretically, it is possible to conceive of spaceships which use the light pressure of a tremendously powerful light beam for propulsion, whereas the so-called adiabatic rockets, i.e. the chemical rockets, thermal and pure atomic rockets, pass the released energy to the whole mass concerned in the reaction, accelerating it to speeds far below that of light. In the adiabatic photon rocket, the whole energy released in a nuclear reaction is radiated in the form of light energy that is not passed to the reacting substances. This gives considerably poorer momentum per unit of energy. With complete transformation of the reaction substance into radiation, momentum output, however, will be equal to that of adiabatic rockets, as both processes coincide here. You can read, these are direct quotations from some of these, the world's greatest scientific minds working on intergalactic space travel, ultimately. It's what they were doing.
Amazing.
It certainly is.
Over on page 037 there, they're talking about a different type of propulsion entirely. And the discovery of this particular propulsion, which was previously unknown, it's an unknown field, actually came up with a MESO field, M-E-S-O. And this field was not even known. And here we've discussed a number of weeks ago, we talked about free energy out in the galaxy.
Yeah.
And essentially, what we're saying there is that there's enough small particles of energy, which of course we're not using, but out in the galaxy, and we can pick those up and use those as a propulsion. And so when we talked about the mesofield, we were talking about this free energy or a version of it. And so when you say that it's free, it essentially is free because it's already there. You just have to get a hold of it.
Right.
And it's in your atmosphere. So again, all you have to do is get a hold of it and use it. But like we've discussed before, the oil companies, some of the electrical companies are forcing us to use their method. And so,
sure.
Once again, it costs us money.
Well, we're captives in the profit-motivated corporations which run the world. We don't have much to say about it, except now we have the opportunity, thanks to you and this data, and this is the first batch of more to come, that we can see how much is out there. There's so much going on. We're really kept in a little thimble in terms of our knowledge. They don't want us to step into a visionary profile. They want to keep us in a simple, reactive situation, not proactive. So here's another little quote from Professor Sanger. He says, talking about this light beam, interplanetary speeds of several percent of the speed of light. In 1953, interplanetary speeds of several percent of the speed of light would be possible. Right? It's light beam.
Everybody knows you can't go faster than 186.
That's right. Now, I ran another story in the headlines the other day that talked about Einstein may be completely wrong, that we can't exceed the speed of light. Now, here it is in 1953 being talked about in this data that is now up for you to read. The professor says its light beam, which is comparable to a hydrogen bomb explosion expanded in time and space, should never pass within several thousand kilometers of the Earth or other spaceships, as it would otherwise burn everything up. So they knew of the vastness of the incredible potential and power of what they were dealing with. They had that, and this is what they were working on. And as Bill says, all over the world, different groups of scientists, in many cases, probably most, unbeknownst to each other, they were daisy-chained together, but it was a secret issue. They were compartmentalized, and yet they were all working toward the same goal of intergalactic, interplanetary travel. And that's what this is about. It's really remarkable. Bill, we have about 2 minutes before we have to pause for our first break, so go ahead.
Well, just a quickie here. When we were talking about this missile field, at the bottom of the page, he says here that this furnishes a slight system of six-dimensional non-lunar differential support for the propulsion system. Now, what he's saying in the whole paragraph is that we look at everything in three dimensions. This fellow that put this package together, he's looking at a system which utilizes six dimensions.
Wow.
And we only know about three. But back when this was being done, this was 53, I'm sorry. This was, these people were studying the space propulsion system as being operated in an environment of six dimensions.
So that's 60, 70 years ago. Now this brings up the other issue, oh my gosh, is right, about Einstein and how many people in physics today say he was the be-all and end-all, and that's where it starts and that's where it ends. He figured it all out. No. He's on the doorstep of walking into an entirely different realm. This is... Even then, people realized that there was so much more going on.
Very good. Excellent.
Now, we have to take a break. If you just joined us, talking with Bill Tompkins, and you're invited to click under Bill's name, and you'll be able to go to the data here, or just look at the third illustrated piece at the top of rents.com, and there's a click here link that'll take you right to the main index page of the UFO ET Interstellar Spacecraft Propulsion Technology Disclosure, which is what this is. Finally, the truth. UFO ET Interstellar Spacecraft Propulsion Technology Disclosure. Underway.
And when we come back, I'm going to talk about another another one of Einstein's theories which doesn't work.
Very good. Wow. We'll do it. Hold on. Bill and I will be right back in just a few minutes.